Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 50 years ago this month, Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique. Our guest this hour has studied that book and what happened as a result of that book very carefully. Stephanie Coons is with us. Her book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Stephanie is Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She writes that her appreciation of the book, The Feminine Mystique, it is interesting. It's one of those books she thought she had read. I'm in the same category. And then you realize many years later that you haven't really read it. Her appreciation of the book grew, she writes, as she talked to people who had read the book when it was first published in the early 1960s, when she went through the letters that Friedan received after the publication and revisited the era in which Betty Friedan wrote. Paradoxically, the less relevant the book seemed now, the more grateful I became to Friedan for reaching out to the many women who, like her mother, had found it a revelation at the time, women who told her over and over that the feminine mystique really transformed their lives, even that it actually saved their lives, or at least their sanity. We'll welcome phone calls for Stephanie Coons during the course of this hour. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And I guess the overall theme of this hour is what's happened to women's lives and men's lives in the workforce and at home since this book was published 50 years ago. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let's start with those phone calls you used to have, because I'm of the generation you are, with your mother. When your mother was reflecting some of the concerns that Betty Friedan had, and you were a college student and you were into a whole different world, there was a big generational divide back in the 60s.
Yes, and it was just, we were just on the cusp of it. I mean, some women my age were also buying into the feminine mystique and the idea that you shouldn't go to college, or if you did, it was only to get your MRS degree, not your PhD. But I was one of the ones who was pretty determined I wasn't going to live like my mom. And I really didn't think of the way that my mom had turned out as something that was not necessarily all her choice and the sort of things that she had been pressured into doing until I started getting these calls from her, you know, and, you know, the no emails, no texting in those days. So we had a weekly call, and about halfway through the school year, she started telling me about this book that she was reading and all of the things that she had learned about how advertisers manipulated you into thinking you were doing something worthwhile by, like, adding an egg to a cake mix that didn't need it. She was so indignant. And then she was telling me about how Freudian psychologists had misrepresented the research. And finally, as she told this, you know, practically, this is why I end up thinking I'd read the book, because she gave me all the cliff notes. But finally, she turned to her own life, and that's when I began to really realize. I got my first inkling before I even did this book many years later, and got such an immersion in what women of that era were going through.
Yeah.
All of the, how she was trying to write a novel, for example, but that she'd always put it away before Dad came home because she didn't think that he would approve.
Right.
So it began to give me an insight. So I was really excited when my editor asked me to go back and review The Feminine Mystique. But as you said at the beginning of the program, I actually had come by then to think that I
think you read
had
it.
Read the book.
Right. Yeah. I'm with you on that. I also think that adding the egg, though, does make you feel like you've baked the cake. I think that's true. The first chapter of your book, you have to be reminded of the way things were so striking to me. All of the statistics, just this I mentioned, in 63 and 64, newspapers dividing their employment ads into two separate sections, help wanted female, help wanted male. And you read this, and it kind of is dumbfounding, isn't it? It wasn't that long ago. My goodness, the difference in the jobs.
Yeah, no, and it didn't even get, the Supreme Court didn't even declare finally that it was illegal to do that until 1973.
Whew.
And then when you read the ads, too, I mean, for I think for young women today, 1963 might as well be 1396. You
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
It's such a different world. They could say things like, I went through the ads for the New York Times of that year, and they would. Advertisers were allowed to say things like, you must be really beautiful to work here.
Right. Must be attractive. Incredible.
First Gal Friday. And, of course, if you did go to work, you had the new employment for flight attendants. You had to be weighed in. You could be fired. Depended on the airline. Some people fired them at 30 and some at 35. And they explained quite unselfconsciously that that's because women lose their looks at that age. And if you put, quote, this is a quote from an airline company president, if you put a dog on a plane, then the businessmen will be unhappy for a week.
Mm. You say you began to think of your main audience as the sidelined wives of the greatest generation. Can you talk more about that?
Well, yeah. And to do that, I have to back up a little bit, because actually when I started reading the book, I got kind of disappointed
mm-hmm.
about how narrow her audience
right.
was and how limited her demands were. You know, the 400 pages in that book, and I don't think you could put together two pages on what became the thrust of the women's rights movement, you know, like abolishing unequal laws and discriminatory hiring practices and protecting women's reproductive rights and stopping sexual harassment, for which there was not even any name in those days. It's all about convincing women, the women who had a choice, and not all women did have a choice, that if they, that even though they could be supported by their husbands and had been told that was the best thing, that actually they should get an education or use the education they already had, and that they had a right to do that. They should not feel guilty for wanting to do that. So initially my reaction was, well, she's only talking to white, middle-class, privileged people. But the more I read about those people, the more I realized that they had their own problems. They were different from the problems that African-American women and white working-class women were facing in that era. But in some ways they were more confusing, because you couldn't point to racism or your employer's bad hiring and job conditions and pay. You had to say, I'm unhappy, but I've been told I should be the happiest person in the world because I have a good provider husband. I went through the Depression as a child. I'm living much better than my parents. My husband doesn't beat me, and very often these women had had that experience. So why am I so unhappy? And women described to me that guilt made them so bad. One woman said she would get up in the morning and she'd start to cry as she washed the dishes, and then she'd say, you're so selfish. Mm. You're going to be punished. That's what happens to women who are selfish. So this group of women really needed the message that Friedan said. And, you know, the message was summed up in an article, one of the first excerpts that they did. She said this headline that evidently the headline writers thought was really, really controversial. It says, I say, as though you're about to, you know, really challenge conventional wisdom. And the rest of the sentence was, women are people, too. But that did challenge conventional wisdom. And what Friedan did for a whole generation of women, most of the women who read her were either had a little more education than was average in those days, the average was only 3 years of high school, or they wanted more education. But they were always told the only point of education is to be a better wife and mother, and don't you use it after you get it. And these women were just feeling so miserable and guilty about not feeling that they were totally complete. And Friedan said to them, you are people too. You have the same aspirations and talents as men. You will not destroy your marriage or your kids' lives if you have some interest outside the home. And it was like, phew. One woman told me that halfway through the book, she flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet.
Oh, my goodness. There's a significant response. Let's, Kian, I find it interesting that you write about and criticized her for really omitting African-American women. And I'm wondering if the book would have been as popular if she had addressed the accomplishments of many African-American women. There were a lot of African-American women who were working, who were leading a civil rights movement, a glaring omission, you write, because she herself had led fights against segregated housing. Black women maybe would have loved to have been homemakers. She missed the chance to show her white middle-class audience that some women were able to combine their identities as wives, mothers, family co-providers, and activists with interests beyond the home. Was it because race was still such a sensitive topic she would lose her white audience if she addressed this?
Well, that's a really important point. And, you know, I think what I was really doing was regretting that she did not do it. But when I think the way you phrase it, could she have done that and still got published even in that era? Certainly gotten excerpts in the major women's magazines? Probably not. You know, one of the myths about Friedan that she herself promulgated was that she'd just been a housewife herself. Well, she had been a student activist at Smith College. She'd helped organize a strike to help get higher wages for the housekeepers who worked in the dorms. She was very interested in left-wing politics and in the civil rights movement. But by the time she came to write this book, she had actually been fired herself from a job because, you know, she had a baby. And she was trying to reach out to a new audience. And she, I think, was beginning to feel, even though she wasn't a housewife, beginning to really empathize with some of the, you know, senses of self-loathing or at least lack of self-esteem that her neighbors felt. So then she kind of said, well, you know, I was just a housewife, too. That's the usual way that you write a woman's magazine, is you make yourself one of your audience. So it was a shame that she felt she had to cover this up. But, boy, in the period of McCarthyism and segregation, Jim Crow, people being beaten for just trying to use a bathroom or a public drinking fountain, you can kind of understand why she played down her other issues, regretful though it made me.
When you think, Stephanie, and when all of us think about how many hours we spend working and about the incredible importance of meaningful work in all people's lives, how did we miss that so much during that era? Everybody needs to have something meaningful to do, and raising children is meaningful, and if you want to do that, fine, but meaningful can be whatever you choose to have it be in the broader society as well. I don't know how we lost track of that.
Well, that was what I think Friedan's big contribution was. She said the reason that we miss this is because of this feminine mystique that says women need no meaning in their life other than that of being a wife and mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she never advocated that you want to do it out by leaving being a wife or mother. She just said you can combine it.
Right.
And, you know, she was absolutely right. The Freudian psychiatrist of the day, for example, Helene Deutsch, who was one of the first of a long line of women who've made a career out of telling other women not to have careers, you know, she said, the normal woman renounces all aspirations, not out of coercion like in the bad old days, but because she understands that her greatest fulfillment will come from the achievements of her husband and her sons. And, of course, the other thing that they said is that women were naturally dependent, passive. They couldn't have a good sexual life. They couldn't have a good adjustment unless they made themselves even more dependent upon men. So this feminine mystique told women that the normal woman gets all the meaning she wants from housewifery. Friedan titled one of her chapters, How Housework Expands to Fill the Time Available. We've certainly found with housewifery and with motherhood, you know, it can do that unless you say to yourself, well, there are other things I want to do in addition to this wonderful one role in my life.
Yeah.
So by giving them that permission to say it's okay to have other meaning and to help them understand how it could improve their lives as women, even as wives and mothers, to have some other sources of meaning and self-esteem. She did a tremendous favor to a whole generation of women that I think would probably have been lost without her. The women's movement would probably have occurred anyway, but this generation of the sidelined wives of the greatest generation, the ones who'd been told during the Depression and the war that really now all that you have to do now is make your husbands happier and create a nicer home now that we're out of the Depression and World War II. That whole group of women, a whole bunch of them, would not have made it, I think, including my mother.
Mm-hmm. When I hear you speak, I realize things have changed, Stephanie. I know there are issues, but things have changed.
Oh, wow. You know, that's something. We, of course, we have issues, and we talk a lot today about the problems of combining work and family. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that you can learn from reading Friedan, or that I learned in researching or in writing this book, was how much worse it was for women when they weren't allowed to combine work and family. And that includes for homemakers. Because can I just add one other
thing? Of course.
There's this myth that somehow working women didn't have their chances in the 50s, but homemakers were better off. Not at all. There were only 8 states in the country where a homemaker who had helped put her husband through school, supported his career by raising the family, had any claim at all upon the income he earned during the marriage. Most states had headmaster law that gave him the final say about where they lived, whether she could take a job, whether she could take out a credit card. There was no such thing as marital rape. Rape in those days was defined as forcible intercourse with someone other than your wife. And domestic violence was not taken seriously. So homemakers were also just terribly vulnerable in those days.
Right. You have me thinking about my mother, too, and I remember her saying to me, she called me Kathy, "Kathy, the only thing I ever wanted to be in life was a good mother. I just wanted to be a good mother." And you know, she was an interesting and challenging mother and a good mother. But when I look at what she did, she only went through high school, but she had worked before the war, you know, during the war, to help in the war effort. She was not college educated, but she did all these jobs on the side. She was a court reporter. She sort of fashioned, she was the gossip columnist for the newspapers where we lived. And I'm thinking she didn't just want to be a mother. That wasn't her, but somebody was telling her that. And I'm thinking now, all these years later, good for you, Mom. You made yourself more. You did some things that you wanted to do that were important to you, and you fashioned out a career that she did sort of on the QT, you know?
Right, on the QT, and perhaps a little bit ashamed of it. I interviewed several women who said that their moms did work, but wouldn't tell anybody. And one of them who said that when she filled out her form for school and her mother had gone back to work, and she herself noticed that her mom was doing much better and was much less depressed now that she was back at home. But she still said that she filled out the form of her mom's occupation as housewife because she thought that the teachers would disapprove.
Interesting. Let's take phone calls. Yeah, we're already getting phone calls coming in. I'm not surprised. Stephanie Coons is our guest. This is 50 years since the publication of The Feminine Mystique. Stephanie has written A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique, and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Stephanie is the Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And we're welcoming phone calls on this huge topic, and we'll start taking your calls momentarily. Did I give you everything? I do this so often you forget you say it. I'm sorry, but I gave you the phone number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Might be interesting for you to post comments on Facebook as well on this conversation of how our lives have changed. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we will be talking with an expert on the millennial generation about how the violence and turmoil they've experienced, 9/11, the economic collapse has affected them and will affect their futures. That's tomorrow during this hour. Stephanie Coons is with us now, and let's go to Todd in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Todd.
Hello.
Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
I just want to say, I'm a man and would never have read The Feminine Mystique, except that I took a gender studies course in college, and it had kind of a strange title, frankly, to me, but it was a great book, truly great. I learned a lot from it, not only about what my mom's life had been like and other women, but also I felt it was relevant to my life, and I actually bought a copy and gave it to my sister, who's a full-time homemaker because she can be. She has a husband who's wealthy enough, and she works really hard being a full-time mom, but I thought she should read it because I thought some of her analysis and some of her message was relevant to my sister, who agreed in part, but she didn't change her life as a consequence. But, yes, I just wanted to say I think that it's still a very relevant book, and I would encourage people to read it. It's not just historical, although it's partly that at this point, but it has relevant messages and analysis for today.
Mm. Thank you, Todd, for the call. What do you find relevant in the message today, Stephanie?
Well, you know, I do find it somewhat dated, and I gave it to my class to read, and there were only a couple of chapters that they still related to. But I do think that I agree with Todd that it's very important, and I also agree that it's really relevant to men. The things that I think are still really important and worth thinking about are, first of all, that we do need meaningful work in our lives, and all the research supports that. Far from, you know, at first when Betty Friedan said that that marriages would be happier and kids would be better adjusted when women felt they had some meaning in their life, everybody just poo-pooed that. But it turns out that she's quite right, that marriages, dual-earner marriages tend to be happier, more egalitarian, and more satisfying to both couples than one-earner couples. When a woman stays home because she wants to, that's fine for her kids, but she's more prey to depression on average. You know, not everyone, but Todd's sister needs to be aware of that this is more likely to cause depression, and depression can be a risk factor for kids. And if a woman goes to work because she doesn't want to, that's a problem. But if she goes to work because she wants to and likes her work, then it's one of those win-win situations like nursing. The more you nurse, the more milk you give, the happier mom is, the better off her kids and her parents are. So the other things that I think are relevant is her discussion of the sexual cell. That's the chapter that my students related most to. And in my concluding chapter, I talk about how that has morphed into the hottie mystique, which is a real problem facing young women, I think, this overemphasis on their sexual appearance. Now they have permission to be smart, to go to school, to achieve, to be strong, to be good at sports, all things they did not have permission to do. But there's this tremendous, much more pressure on them to be hot. And then I think there's that a sophisticated reader of that book, like Todd, can take from it the idea that maybe there's a masculine mystique as well that also prevents me from having the full range of authentic experiences, aspirations, and feelings that I should have. And I think that is an increasingly important problem for men today as they struggle to relate to the new demands and desires to be involved in household activities and childcare.
I found that interesting. We don't think about that very often, but you talk about men experiencing some of the same consequences when they try to return to a workforce if they have taken time off or family leave, or if they're responding to a child's sickness. That's a difficult road for men now.
It is, and so there are prejudices against both men and women. One of the interesting things we find is that the instant a woman becomes a mother at work, she is seen as less competent,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you assume that the mom will take time for kids. That doesn't happen to the father. The instant a man becomes a father, he's seen as equally competent but more warm. However, as soon as he starts to actually ask for family time, that goes out the window. And men report to pollsters that they're often afraid to take the leave that they are entitled to, or they'll even pretend. They'll say they've got their own doctor appointment instead of saying it's my turn to get up at childcare.
Oh.
Yeah, isn't that sad that they feel pressured that way, the same way women felt pressured not to want to work. They feel pressured not to want to be so involved at home.
Let's go. Thank you, Chad, so much for your call. Nancy in Madison. Hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you. This is very interesting to me because I fall into this demographic. But I wanted to ask you about the role that women's magazines played at that time, because there was Good Housekeeping and Better Homes and Gardens and McCall's. And they often had a column in there where you would write in or call in and ask a doctor for advice or someone else that you've thought of as an authority figure, but the questions would be often had to do with something about housekeeping or some domestic role. And one that I remember so well was a comment that said your husband would be much happier if he came home to a happy baby and a nice warm casserole in the oven rather than having you go out to work and both of you coming home and slapping a couple of steaks on the grill. So that stayed with me, and I thought, well, yes, that's right. That's how it should be. And I'm afraid I fell into that for quite a period of time. So I would like you to answer the role about the magazines and but how they reinforced.
Okay, and Nancy, at what point did you say, I'm not going to buy into that anymore?
Well, let's see. I did read that book, and it had to do with the fact that I moved to Madison, and I was able to go back to school. I was very happy to come back here because my first thought was, oh, good, I can complete my education. Because up to that point, I moved with my husband wherever his job took him.
Mm-hmm.
So we came here in 1964, and it's always been the best thing that ever happened to me.
Stephanie?
Well, you know, it's funny because some of those women who were the editors of the ladies' magazines were actually frustrated by some of their articles, and occasionally they would sneak new things in, and they would have people, they would do a profile of a woman who had a career but was still a good mom. But on the whole, you're absolutely right. The way that this reinforced this idea, I actually compared magazines written for middle-class women, like the Ladies' Home Journal and Red Book and Good Housekeeping, with the magazines that were written for working-class women. And it was the magazines written for middle-class women that really emphasized this sort of Freudian idea that you were neurotic if you weren't interested in being passive. Ladies' Home Journal had this, can this marriage be saved? And sometimes the questions in it would be like, well, we're unhappy because of this, we're unhappy because of that. They always had a happy ending, but it always involved the woman giving up any extra insight, aspirations outside the home, learning to enjoy baking cookies, adjusting to her, you know, to making more support for her husband, being more supportive of his insecurities. And in fact, one of the shocking things in researching this book, I talk about it in one of the chapters, is I actually then went to the records of psychological clinics and mental institutions.
Yeah.
I would say over and over again, if a wife said, well, I think my husband's having an affair, their reaction was, well, are you keeping yourself well-groomed enough? Are you putting good food on the table? And to get out, you got committed to an institution, and often you did, just because you were unhappy as a housewife, the exit interviews, you couldn't get out unless you said things. I'm not exaggerating this. One woman wrote, well, I've learned to bake cookies and be happy. Or I've learned that I must not worry about things like having a career. And then the psychiatrist said, oh, she's cured.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you need to stop and pause after what you just said because it sounds so incredulous now.
I know.
Thank you very much, Nancy, for the call. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. I remember buying my first Playboy and picking up a copy of Betty Friedan's book in the early 60s. And today I'm wondering, wouldn't we all be better off if homemakers were paid a higher than average wage? Period.
Stephanie?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I understand that one of the problems facing homemakers historically was their lack of access to money of their own, and the fact that their work was not socially valued. But I think that a much better solution would be to reorganize our work schedule, our family leave policies, which are the worst in the entire advanced industrial world, and make it possible for people to combine work and family to the extent that they prefer. Some people may choose to have a woman stay home. Some people may choose to have the man stay home. More and more, though, what men and women say they want is they want to be able to combine household work and breadwinning work equally. But we are the only country in the advanced, not just the advanced world, but the only country outside of a few islands in the world that doesn't have subsidized maternity leave for women, that doesn't have paternity leave for men. We're one of 81 other countries have paternity leave for men. We organize our work schedules and policies on the idea that one person is to be totally available to work and one is to be totally available to take care of the rest of life. Not only does that deny women who want to work, to combine work and family, a good way to do that, but it denies men an access to a good family life. And that's what I object to about the idea that we could solve this problem by paying homemakers. Because in many ways, then, we are denying men access to the satisfactions of being really involved parents at home, and we're denying the kids access to their fathers. So I think a better solution would be just to make it easier for people to combine work and family in ways that other countries are doing. Americans report the highest work-family conflicts in the world, and American men have now surpassed women in the amount of work-family conflict they feel because they do want to get more involved at home and still can't do so.
We've been talking for years and years and years about quality daycare close to the workplace. Not all that hard to do. Make it so people can afford it. And it just doesn't happen, Stephanie. And now everybody's in the workforce. I just don't understand that.
No, it's shocking. 70% of American children live in households where every adult in the home is involved in the workforce. We have to come to terms with that for the sake of our society, for the sake of our kids, for the sake, actually, of having a good work environment and more productivity.
Right.
Every European country has much better child care. It's more regulated, so it's actually better for the kids. We have very low-quality child care, except for those who can afford the really expensive private stuff. So the combination of having high-quality child care that is regulated, has national standards, leave for parents, the ability to work, to drop to part-time work if you want to. For example, in Europe, a person who drops to part-time work, the employer cannot deny them access to pension benefits and health insurance and cannot pay them less per hour than they do for full-time work, which makes it much more possible for people to make these family-friendly adjustments, whereas in the United States we have no rule like that at all, and typically part-time workers doing the same job that they did when they were full-time are paid less per hour.
Stephanie Kuhns, our guest this hour, her book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was published 50 years ago, and Stephanie was asked to write a book looking at the influence of the feminine mystique, and so she read the book and talked to women who had been greatly influenced by this book. So we're looking at the importance of that book historically, where women were in society, particularly middle-class white women in the 1960s, and how this book was a tremendously important piece of work for those women, and where we are now and where we have yet to be. Our phone number, thanks, Kenneth, for your call. We have lines open right now. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to send us one of those, is talk@WPR.org. And we have a Facebook page as well, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your messages there. Two more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to more phone calls. Howard in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I read The Feminine Mystique when I was in college 20 years ago, and I got to tell you, it completely gave it, a light bulb went on, and I felt like I really understood my mom and her generation. You know, she graduated Phi Beta Kappa, she could speak three languages, and then when I came along 40 years ago, she basically went home. And I got to tell you, after reading the book, I kind of understand why she did that. And I know you said that your students find it dated, but I think there's value in students reading it in 2013 because it gives insight into the way things were and to shows how challenging it was for women of the generation before them. Because the women of today and all of us today stand on the shoulders of Betty Friedan and those that came before us. And if there is like a competition, it has to be the Feminine Mystique. I would place it in the top 100 books of the 20th century in the English language. And I'll take any comments off the air.
Thanks,
Thank
Howard.
You very much.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think you're absolutely true, absolutely right. I like to warn people that if they take for granted what we have, they may find parts of it boring, but if they actually read it as a document as to what life was like. And what I really particularly like in what you said is how it helped you understand your mother, because some of the most touching interviews that I did for my book were with women and men who had suddenly realized what their moms went through. Often it was like your reaction, well, now I understand why she made those choices. Often, though, I also got a whole bunch of interviews with people whose mothers had been depressed, even suicidal, who had been mean and angry a lot, and they'd grown up resenting their mothers, and suddenly one woman said to me, it was like going back and seeing the director's cut of a film and understanding my mother's life. And I've had many, many, one man said to me, it made me resolve that I would never treat my wife the way that my mother had been treated, not meanly, but just with all the assumptions that my father had made about how she should live her life and what her responsibilities are. So I think that's a very good comment. Thank you for calling.
When he talked about how important the book was historically, you cite the fact that liberal publications consider it where in its ranking, and conservative publications and have the opposite response to the book, that it's one of the worst influences on American society ever.
Yes. One conservative site ranks it right down a couple of things below Mein Kampf.
Goodness
how
gracious.
Horrible they think it was.
Josie is next in New Berlin. Hi, Josie.
Hi. I just want to talk about an experience somewhat similar to the last call, I think. My children asked me why I lived the life I did. When we moved to Milwaukee about 1964, we both had college degrees. I had a master's degree in library science. My husband went out to get a job and got a job very easily because they said he had a large family. They thought he'd work hard. I went out to get a job, and nobody would even look at my interview because I had too many children. They had, at that time, you had to write how many children you had, what provisions you had to take care of them throughout the, all your work day. And I couldn't even get an oral interview because they'd look at it and say, no, she wouldn't be coming to work.
Wow. Well, that reminds me of a something that happened. The flight attendants were not allowed to be married or to have kids. And when one flight attendant kept the existence of her child a secret, and it was found out, the airline generously offered her the choice between resigning or putting her child in an orphanage.
Oh, my gosh. Putting her child in an orphanage. Oh, no.
I actually started listing less children. That was before Facebook, and they couldn't find out much about it.
Oh,
so I started listing less children, and I did finally get a job that way.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't it amazing, though? Here you are with a master's degree, for heaven's sake. You obviously knew education was important, and then nobody would hire you. Oh.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Josie. Thanks. I'll bet some of the women that you interviewed had similar ideas about how to enter the workforce. I don't have four kids. I have one.
Uh-huh. Well, yes. And there were a lot of women who did that kind of lying. But, gosh, it was hard to get by. I mean, think about our first Supreme Court justice, Sandra Day O'Connor. She graduated second in her class from Stanford, editor of the prestigious Stanford Law Review. When she tried to get a job, nobody would hire except one firm who said, well, of course we don't hire women as lawyers, but you would make a great legal secretary.
Oh, my gosh. Right. Thanks, Josie. Valerie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I guess I just want to say something about how strongly I feel I'm an educator, and that I feel that there is a tremendous lack of ability for parents to be able to be really good parents because they're so busy with jobs, and there are so many households where both parents have to work, and I get that. But I just, you know, if you're going to make a choice to have children, then I think you really need to plan really well ahead about how those children are going to be raised. And I just feel strongly that other people don't raise your children as well as you do if you're a dedicated parent and understand the responsibilities.
Stephanie.
Well, I have to respectfully disagree a little bit. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of places where people are overwhelmed and don't do well as parents. But if you look back to the 1960s, you'll find that women, mothers who were stay-at-home mothers, actually spent less time interacting with their kids than most working mothers today. If you look back in history, exclusive maternal child care is very rare. In colonial days, kids were raised by their older siblings or by servant neighbor girls who came in as servants to get experience in raising kids. If you look all the way back to history, Sarah Hardy, this wonderful anthropologist, describes how alloparents, people who were not biologically related but who helped in the child in raising a child. I think, you know, every family is different, and we all, of course, have to be able to prioritize the responsibilities and the dependencies that we bring into the world. But I don't think it's the work outside the home that is the problem. I think that the lack of family-friendly work policies, the fact that school schedules are not set up, you know, either there's not childcare or time off to attend parent-teacher conferences, or they're not scheduled at the right time. I think there's a lot of things we can do. But as someone who worked all through my own, raising my own child, and am now watching that son graduate from medical school, having spent the last 5 years with every free time doing humanitarian work outside the country, I know from experience that despite the guilt I often felt and the frustration I often felt, that you don't necessarily neglect your kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just respectfully disagree also.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Valerie, for the call. Mark in Monona. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. I just have two observations. One of them is that Wisconsin was the first state to adopt the Equal Rights Amendment, which he didn't eventually succeed. And in 1973, the Wisconsin State Journal published a profile of Wisconsin women legislators, and they identified the legislators as Mrs. and then their husband's name, which in 1973 strikes me as really bizarre. But the question I have is, can your guest outline sort of the history of the Equal Rights Amendment, its eventual failure, and the role of the Eagle Forum in that?
Well, I can do a little. It sounds like you probably know more about it more of the details than I. But as you know, the Equal Rights Amendment had been being proposed since the 1930s, and it finally got into being treated seriously only after the development of the women's movement. And that's a really important part of women's history. For example, when women were added to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it was considered a joke and a fluke, and the people who were charged with enforcing it, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, actually refused to enforce it when it came to women.
Was it included because of Betty Friedan's book?
No, it was not. It was included actually out of a very interesting maneuvering between female Congress people who really wanted the Equal Rights Amendment and thought that maybe this was a time they could get it through because people were so concerned with the South's intransigence about racial inequality.
Mm-hmm.
But then there were also some people who opposed the entire amendment and thought that if they added women, they could defeat it. So it was kind of a fluke, and the only time it got taken seriously was after Friedan, Paula Murray, a black lawyer, a feminist, and others formed the National Organization for Women in 1966 and began to pressure for it. And so to get back to the ERA, that really only began to be taken seriously when NOW and emerging new women's groups that came out of a younger generation of women in the late 60s and 70s began to pressure for it. But, of course, the two biggest arguments against it, the most effective arguments, were, one, ooh, you might have unisex toilets, and two, women might serve in the military.
Oh, my goodness. Yep, big, wow. Enough said.
But yes, it was a huge, huge, the Eagle Forum and people like Phyllis Schlafly.
Yes,
I remember. Going back to my earlier comment about Helene Deutsch, another woman who's made a career out of telling other women not to have careers.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark, very much for the call. I'm interested in how word was spread about her book. Her book was excerpted. What was excerpted and run in magazines?
Well, that's really interesting because for all of the problems with the women's magazines, this is where I think you get this sort of closet feminist group of editors. It got immense, immense attention from women's magazines. The first excerpt came out a year or two before it was published in Good Housekeeping. Then the publisher agreed to delay publication to February instead of January so that first the Ladies' Home Journal and then McCall, I think it was McCall's or Red Book, I'm blanking right now, could do an excerpt from it, one in January, one in February. This is unheard of. As someone who has published several books myself, a woman's magazine is not going to do the same excerpt or even an interview with somebody who is a competitor. So they considered it very, very important, which was lucky because the book actually came out in the middle of the New York newspaper strike, so it didn't get the reviews that initially that would have helped it. So a lot of this came from people reading. One woman described to me somebody else passing it to her at the hairdresser's under the hairdryer and reading it and then going out to buy the book. So a lot of it was word of mouth. But it was also sold to a book club and went into paperback. And between that sort of interest and the word of mouth, it became an international bestseller.
Hmm. Let's go to Mary in Greendale. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share my mom's story. She was born in 1920, grew up in a farming community, Maple Grove, Wisconsin, and there were six children in her family. They all had a higher education, and four of the six went into education themselves, and certainly they had success with teaching many, many children. And my mother taught in a rural farm school or little school, one-room schoolhouse, until she started having children. And then she did substitute teaching all while I was growing up. I remember her really being needed in a lot of different places. And I actually had the experience of having her substitute me in fourth grade. It wasn't the easiest thing, but I did appreciate that she was a great teacher. And I just have so much affection for women who worked so hard and taught us while we were growing up. So I just wanted to give a kudos to them.
Thank you, Mary. Stephanie.
What a lovely story. Mm-hmm. What a lovely story.
Yeah, absolutely lovely. So in the minute that we have left, what do we have to work on still?
Well, I think we have to work on making sure that women still have choices, that we overcome some of the continuing prejudices that women face. I think we also have to be really aware of the increased problems that men face. As their values change and our expectations of men change, they in some ways are still more stuck in the masculine mystique and get teased and penalized more often if they want to do things that were not traditionally masculine than women are. So we have to incorporate them. And above all, I think we have to make it possible for women and men who want to work not to have to make choices between work and family, like every other advanced nation in the industrial world is doing. We have to provide decent child care, parental leaves, abilities for part-time work, and more flexible, family-friendly policies and school hours.
You wonder what's wrong with us sometimes, don't you? We just don't get it on some vital issues.
You know, I used to say that we were kind of like Neanderthals, and then I read all this stuff that explains that Neanderthals took much better care of their dependents than we do.
Stephanie, thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Really, what wonderful callers you had, too.
Yeah, don't we? We have a terrific audience. Stephanie Kuhns, our guest, her book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour and Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We got kind of captivated by this Richard III story, maybe because American Players Theater did this terrific Richard III last year, and it is the most performed of Shakespeare's plays. So lo and behold, when they find the body, and it's been there for how many hundreds of years of Richard III, a couple weeks ago we thought, well, we got to do a show on that. So the first hour of tomorrow's program, researchers whose research led to the discovery will be with us tomorrow. They're from the University of Leicester. And please, I hope you'll tune in.